The unruffled beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals Wednesday, 8 p.m., and time for So What's Your Story. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted to live storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT, 90.1 FM Houston. I'm your host, Warren Holloman, and I'm proud to be a part of the best team on the radio. Hank Rubicek, Greg Aldell, Mary Edgerton are my co-hosts. Nicole Rocherlin Grady is our media maven and engineer. Tatiana Gago, our intern. And Teddy Puig is our production assistant. Each week, we revel in the power of story by placing the spotlight on remarkable tellers. Some are starters and some are stars, but all engage us with stirring personal stories as well as treasured traditional folk tales. And all take us on captivating journeys and then return us safely to the present. Tonight promises to bring you both the stirring and the captivating, because my guest plays two unique roles that, well, they're not usually coupled together. She's an attorney, and she's also a minister. Diane McGeehee is the pastor of Bering Memorial United Methodist Church, just a few blocks down the street from our studio here at KPFT. For years, Bering has been and continues to play a pivotal role in shaping and supporting the Montrose community, not the least of which is serving as a role model for tolerance and diversity. Tonight, Diane will showcase her own diversity by telling stories that range from those inspired by the Bible to those that reflect her own personal journey. She'll tell a story about loaves and fishes, but she'll also tell a story about birthday cakes. One of her stories will be about regret and another about redemption. Diane, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. And I've just got to ask right from the get-go, how is it possible for a lawyer and a minister to inhabit the same body?
Well, actually, they inhabit the same body really well. They go hand in hand because to be a minister, one of my favorite stories is when Jesus gets up and describes what he's going to be about in the world. And he says, the Spirit is on me. Has anointed me to bring good news to the poor, release to the captives, to set at liberty the oppressed. And so for me, being a pastor is about helping us address the injustice in the world so that people can find life and hope and freedom. And as an attorney, I'm also called to be a servant of justice. So those two complement each other, and both attorneys and pastors are called to be storytellers. When I'm in a courtroom telling my client's story, I need to be able to engage a jury so that they can enter that story and respond. And that's the same thing I do when I'm preaching from a pulpit. I want to tell a story that's life-giving, that connects with people's lives in a way that they can enter that story and connect theirs to it and respond as well.
I love your answer. I think I told you earlier my father was an attorney.
Yes.
And that's how he would have answered it as well. He saw himself as being the person in the community who tried to stand for justice and get things right, which is the same thing the minister was trying to do, and they kind of partnered.
That's right, and that's how I see them inhabiting my body.
And now I know you're the pastor at Bering Methodist, which according to the map on my cell phone is only 6 blocks from where we're sitting right here in the studio. I was flying Southwest Airlines about 3 years ago, and they had these free podcasts on things that were amazing about Texas and Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And would you believe that Bering Church was the subject of one of the podcasts?
I would believe it. It's an amazing place. You know, as a United Methodist pastor, we get appointed to churches. And so I actually, when I heard that Bering was open for a new pastor, I begged to be appointed there because its DNA is a place with people who stand for other people. And that's been their whole history as part of Houston. You know, originally, Bering was founded as an immigrant congregation for German-speaking immigrants who really weren't welcomed in a lot of places, including some churches. So they've always stood in that place for the immigrant community. And then in the late 1800s, when yellow fever broke out, they organized nurses to help care for those afflicted with that disease in the community and led the whole community in caring for those who were sick. And then that happened again in the early 1900s with the influenza pandemic.
Right.
And then when AIDS broke out, Behring led the way with Behring Omega and Behring Support Networks in providing care for those who were afflicted and dying from AIDS. They've also invested in helping historically to start Methodist Hospital. They've worked with the Emergency Aid Coalition, with Interfaith Ministries. They helped found Search for Homeless folks on our streets, and now they have a ministry with young adults between the age of 18 and 30 who are also on the streets or in unstable housing and who need support, and they're providing that. And so it's an awesome place to be a pastor because I have a community of people who really stand in the world for others.
I've often told people that somebody needs to write a book about the history of the AIDS epidemic in Houston, and particularly the role that Behring played. Behring took care of a lot of my friends, the hospice, back 30 years ago. In fact, I told a story at the Moth about one of those friends and had a tremendous impact on this community. And I just hope that we can preserve those stories while people who remember them are still around.
So we have a lot of those recorded in our archives, and you're right, it's an important story. And those stories are important today because HIV/AIDS is still present, and we're still facing that challenge, and people need support in that area. And Behring has also stood historically for the LGBTQ community and continues to stand for full inclusion in the church as well as in community and society for all people, but particularly that community.
Well, one of the things that ministers do is to tell stories from the Bible. You told me earlier you particularly like to tell stories that empower people to stand up for themselves, to stand up for others, empowered by the love of God to do that. Could you share with us one of your favorite Bible stories that reflects that empowerment and that love?
Yes, there are a lot of them, but one of them that I remember being told from the time I was a little child was when Jesus fed 5,000 people. And actually, that was 5,000 men because that's who they counted. And so along with those 5,000 men, there were women and children. So he probably fed about 20,000 people, actually. But what happened is that Jesus and his disciples had gotten into a boat and crossed the Sea of Galilee. They were tired. They were looking for a deserted place to be alone and to rest. But the crowd had heard that they were heading that way. And so people who were sick, people who were poor, people who needed to be cared for, had walked for miles and for hours around the shore so that when the boat arrived, they were there waiting for Jesus. And of course, when Jesus saw them, he had compassion on them, and he got out of the boat and he spent the day caring for them, healing the sick, listening to people about their concerns, and just sharing the love of God with them. And as the day began to wane and it was getting late, the disciples became concerned because the people were poor, they had come a long way, and there was no food, and they knew they were hungry, and they didn't have anything, at least they didn't think they did, to take care of them. And so they came to Jesus and said, Jesus, we've got to send them away. We've got to send them somewhere so they can find food because they need to be taken care of that way. And Jesus smiles at them and says, nope, we're not going to do that. We're going to take care of them. You feed them. And of course, the disciples are like, what? We can't feed them. We don't have food for this many people. And there's no place we can go get it. There's no way we can do this. We need to send them to somebody else. We don't have the resources. And even if there was some place we could get that kind of food, we don't have that kind of money. It would cost us 2/3 of a year's wages to feed this many people. And we don't have those kind of resources. There's no way we can do this. And Jesus just smiles at them and says, we're not going to send them away. So let's look at what we've got to work with. What do we have? Now, as they're having their discussion, there's this little boy in the crowd, and he overhears this conversation. And he looks down, and he's got in his hands this little cloth wrapped around 5 little biscuits and 2 little fish about the size of sardines. And he thinks to himself, I wonder if this could help. And then he probably questions, no, they would think this is silly. Look at all these people. They'll just laugh at me. But then he thought, I really want to help. I really want to give something. I want to do something. And so he comes up to Andrew, one of the disciples, and he says, Mister, I have this lunch. Do you think that would help? Do you think Jesus could use this? And of course, Andrew doesn't know whether to laugh or cry because there's 20,000 people and this little boy, and he thinks, well, this little boy needs this lunch, and so I should just tell him no. But then he looks in the little boy's face and he sees that this little boy wants to offer something, that it matters to him to be able to contribute. And so Andrew says, sure. You know what? This is great. I know Jesus can use that. And so he takes him over to Jesus, and he probably kind of pulls Jesus aside and says, Jesus, you know, this little boy has this little lunch, and I know it's not much, but this is really important to him. Do you think we could do something? And Jesus' face, I imagine, just busted out with a smile and said, absolutely, we can work with this. Let's use it. And he goes over and takes the lunch from the little boy and looks at him and says, this is great. I can use this. And then he lifts it up to God. He gives thanks to God and to the little boy, and he begins to break it into pieces, and he asks the disciples to have people sit down, and he continues to distribute the food until everyone is filled and has more than enough. And then he says, collect up the extras, and there are 12 baskets left over. And he says, now give those to the people, and as they go home, tell them to share what they have with someone else.
If you're just tuning in, this is So What's Your Story here on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston and 89.5 in Galveston and 91.9 in Huntsville. I'm Warren Holloman. I'm here with my guest, Reverend Diane McGeehee. Diane, I love the way you told that story. It's an old story, and I'm guessing it's been told about a million times.
I'm sure it has.
You heard it as a child. So did I. But you put your own unique perspective into it. What is it about that story that speaks to you?
I think all of us want to contribute. I think all of us have something we want to offer, but we question it. We think it's not good enough. We compare ourselves to what somebody else has that looks like it's so important. And what God calls us to do is give what we've got. And when we give it with great love, God will take it and use it and multiply it in ways that will surprise us. And so we all have something to offer.
So we think that our resources are not enough. We think that what we have to offer is not enough.
That's right.
It's meager.
Mm-hmm.
And we should focus more on what we do have and
That's
how
right.
God can use it.
I love the way Mother Teresa said it, because she said, not all of us are called to do great things, but we're all called to do small things with great love. And when we offer what we have with great love, it can make a tremendous difference.
I remember as a child thinking, how am I supposed to apply this to my life? Am I supposed to take my lunch at school each day and break it up into little pieces and start passing it around? Is that the idea?
Well, it might be, but it's what do I have and who could I offer it to that it actually might make a difference in their lives?
Yeah. And I know, because full disclosure here, I'm a member of Bering Church, and I heard you tell this story about a month ago, and I said, oh, I want her to tell this on the radio. And then you did a technique that a lot of good storytellers do. You used another story to interpret this story,
yes,
or to explain it. And I was wondering if you could tell that second story, the story that you used, the contemporary story you used to explain a very old biblical story.
Yep.
And a story that is about how someone who had seemingly very little to offer actually made a significant difference.
Yes, it is. It's another one of my favorite stories. I have a lot of them. But Ruth is an 80-year-old woman who changed an entire community by baking a birthday cake. And so before I became the pastor at Bering, I worked with a lot of churches trying to help them reach out to the diverse community that now we're blessed to be a part of. And in Texas, we have a lot of Hispanic families, Spanish speakers from all over the world. And a lot of times we're intimidated because we don't know the language and we have different cultures, and so we don't reach out. And so I was working with churches to help them overcome those kinds of obstacles so that we could build relationships. And I ran into Ruth in Arkansas. Arkansas and the ministry that she had helped create. And this is her story. She was the founding member of this little church that had historically been Anglo-English speaking, and she had been a member for 50 years. And over time, the neighborhood had changed, and now across the street from the church was a large apartment complex with mostly Spanish-speaking families. And every morning, she would climb up the church steps when she went to worship on Sundays, and she would look out and say to herself, I wish I could do something. I wish there was some way that we could get to know those families, that we could help them and they could help us, but I don't know what to do. And so she was a woman of prayer, and she began to pray this very simple prayer every day, God, what can I do? And she prayed that for months. And she began to hear inside her soul a response that really frustrated her, because the only response she got back to the prayer, what can I do, was a question. What can you do? And she got frustrated in her prayer. She would say, God, I'm asking you that. I don't know what to do. What can I do? And finally, as that answer kept coming back as a question, what can you do? She got it. God was asking her, what can you do? And she said in her prayer, she said, well, God, I'm 80. I can't walk like I used to. I don't have much in the way of finances. I can't do all the things I used to. But one thing I still do and I love to do is I bake birthday cakes. And she heard God say, well, then bake a birthday cake. And so she did. She baked a birthday cake. She took it to church the next Sunday. She went to the youth group and she found one of the high school students who was taking Spanish. And she said, would you come with me after church across the street to the apartment complex? And would you help me ask some of the families if any child has a birthday this week, because I want to give that child a birthday cake. And so they did. They went over. They found a child. They gave the child a birthday cake. And she did that for a couple months. And then she discovered that sometimes there was more than one child. So she started baking two and three cakes. And soon she had other youth from the youth group coming over and helping, and other people from the church helping her make more cakes. And then that led to bringing lunch and having lunch and learning how to make tamales and learning how to make piñatas and learning how to make a lot of the pupusas, all the different sorts of things that that community had to offer. And before long, this relationship began between this church and this apartment complex and all of the families. And today, they worship together. They work together. They have built a relationship. They have created a new story together, all because one woman did what she could. She baked a birthday cake. I love that story.
It's incredible on so many levels. I think one is that, a little heads up to Nicole and Tatiana and Ted, I'm going to ask your input here in just a minute, but one of the reasons this story strikes me is that we have an unlikely hero.
Yeah. Who would expect that an 80-year-old woman could change a whole community?
Yeah. And the way she's able to cross so many barriers.
By just offering what she had to offer and offering it with love.
And the similarity to the biblical story.
Absolutely.
It's a small child in that story. It's a very elderly person in this story. But someone on the margin, and person you would not suspect. So she, I guess I could say she's my idea of a hero.
Absolutely. And we all can be heroes because we all have something to offer.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to check in with Nicole Rocherlin and Tatiana and Teddy. We all come from different faiths and different backgrounds, and yet stories like these have a universal quality. And I'd like to know how those first two stories spoke to you all.
Well, this is Nicole. Well, I would like to say first and foremost that I thank you, Reverend Diane, because just this past weekend, I went to a shift conference for women with Dream Build Success. Mm. And this was exactly the things that we were talking about, is that how we're taking what God has naturally given us, and it can be our time, it can be our money, it can be just a smile, and just share it with others. And just because it's pure from our heart, then that is how it keeps going, and it blesses others. And I mean, you just have to trust the process and keep it going. So it just helped me to remember exactly all the things that I learned during that conference, and just to, you know, reiterate that, you know, hey, God is real. And by doing what he tells us to do, then from that we will be blessed.
Had you heard that story before, the first one?
I've heard that story, not that rendition. Yeah. It's one of my favorite stories. But yeah, it reminds me of that song. I think it's by Shirley Caesar. I love singing that song about it when she's singing about the two fish and five loaves of bread. So yeah, that's a gospel song related to it as well. But yes, I've heard this story several times.
Yeah. Great. I see Tatiana's grabbing the microphone.
Yeah. Well, for me, the feeding of 5,000, I have heard this story before because I grew up in Catholic school. So, of course, we don't all get these type of biblical stories. And like how Nicole said, you have to trust the process. There is a God. I remember because that's what they always told us. And of course, when we give, when we receive, we also should give. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned 5,000. One of the details of the story that she mentioned is that the crowd actually was probably closer to 20,000. Had you heard that before?
It's been a while, but
okay.
Yeah, they didn't count women and children then. So when we say feeding of the 5,000, they're just counting the men, but there was a whole crowd of women and children too.
I mean, that's just a tiny statistical detail. It doesn't seem that central to a narrative or a story, and yet that's the thing I may remember as much as anything from what you've said tonight. The fact that they weren't counted says a lot about
all the growth we still have to do in terms of who we count and who we regard as significant, and everybody counts, and everybody was fed until they had their full.
I mean, that's another interpretation of that story I hadn't even thought of. Everybody counts.
Right. And that's part of what I love about biblical stories, is because they're alive and they have so many different applications. Depending which character you identify with in the story, there's a whole another layer of meaning that you can discover.
Yeah. Teddy, let's check in with you. Your thoughts?
Well, I thought it was a great story. You know, it was really like the epitome of the New Testament for me, you know, just with real emphasis on generosity and just really on giving, you know. It's heartwarming.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. And then the story about the, Diane, maybe we could talk for a minute about the woman in the congregation, the elderly woman mm-hmm. who started baking birthday cakes.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about the impact she had on the community. I'm just speculating what the impact might have been on her.
Oh, it gave her meaning. It gave her purpose. You know, a lot of times we kind of shelve people as they get older and don't give them a place. And they often can feel like they're not as useful or they don't have a purpose anymore. And it gave her purpose. It connected her deeply with a much wider community that enriched her life. And so at a time when a lot of folks become isolated, it actually expanded her community. And so it was an incredible gift to her because she took a risk to offer what she had and trust that it would be enough.
One of the things I hear you saying often is, or terms you use often, is the term community. And I guess I grew up hearing the term church, where you use the term community. Could you comment on that?
Well, for a lot of people, church has negative connotations. It's unfortunately, historically, it has been a place where people have been wounded or people have been excluded. And so when you really look at Jesus' ministry, what he was doing within a religious community, he was building a community of inclusion, of people being welcomed, of people being celebrated, of people's dignity being restored, of people being restored into relationship. And so the concept of community has a much broader reach for us, and that's what we're really talking about, a community of God, a community of the children of God, which includes all of us. There's a place for all of us at the table. Sometimes with church, you know, we think about denominational lines and all the kinds of things that unfortunately sometimes divide us. And for me, community is about this wide, expansive inclusion of God that welcomes everyone to the table and gives them a place of dignity, a place of contribution, a place to be celebrated.
And in the Methodist Church, everyone is welcome at the table. Is that how it works?
Yes and no. We are struggling with including LGBTQ folks fully, and it's heartbreaking to me because I believe the gospel message is one that says all of us are created in the image of God as we are, and that that uniqueness, whether I'm straight or gay or lesbian or transgender or you know, whether I have one sexual orientation or one gender identification or another, it's all part of God's plan. It's all part of God's richness of creation that we celebrate in. And so, yes, I do believe that Methodist theology at its core welcomes everyone. We've just, some of us have gotten that confused. And so we're working to change that.
Well, one of the things that attracted me to Bearing years ago is that it was so, it did embrace everyone. And people say, why do you go there? And I say, it just feels like my idea of what a church should be. And I guess the term really I should be using is community, because that's what it feels like to me.
It's a faith community. It's a community that says, yes, everyone's welcome. And that's part of why I love being the pastor there, because I think that is the commitment of Bearing. And of course, we all have to grow into that. We'll discover in some of these other stories, we all make judgments that sometimes unconscious, you know, that exclude people. And we have to own our brokenness. We have to redeem that. We have to reach out beyond our narrow focus sometimes. But Bearing's commitment is to include everyone, to celebrate everyone. And I think they do an amazing job of that.
I agree. Well, speaking of community, we're going to give you a little bit of a break and do our community calendar. And now I'm talking about the storytelling community. Nicole, why don't you start us off?
Absolutely. Well, as you all know, the Houston Storytellers Guild has a couple of big events on the horizon. On Saturday, November 18th, they'll be hosting award-winning storyteller Donna Ingham. The time is from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m., and the place is Hickory Hollow, located at Washington and Center Street in the Heights. There's no cost, but buy yourself some lunch and enjoy hearing Donna tell her signature Texas stories. Then, a few hours later, once again on Saturday, November 18th, join the Houston Storytellers Guild for their annual Telebration Celebration in honor of the National Night of Storytelling. This event will be at the Black Lab on Montrose Boulevard. So go to www.houstonstorytellers.org for all the details. And while you're there, click on the Radio Program tab, where you'll find every So What's Your Story program since 2008.
And Hank is here in the studio.
I am. And I'm just fascinated by the stories, Diane. I love the stories. I really do. And you know, I wasn't asked what kind of impact they made on me. And I we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But you're a wonderful, wonderful storyteller. You make
Thank
an indelible
you.
Impression on everybody who has the good fortune of listening to you. Donna Ingham, let me just say a few words about her, if I may. She's going to be my guest next week, and I'm really excited about that. And you're going to want to listen in, because you're going to want to listen to what you don't want to miss on November 18th. Donna is really, when we talk about award-winning telling, she is the consummate teller. She's a lot like Larry Thompson last year. Some of you may remember we had him do a concert at Hickory Hollow, and he was fabulous, and Donna's going to be and Donna's going to be great, and as Nicole pointed out, it's a really expensive venue. You got to walk in with absolutely nothing. You have to show people that you have no money in order to get in. That's as cheap as it comes. So have lunch, grab coffee, or pretend like you're eating, but make sure that you go there and enjoy Donna.
And I believe you're going to have Donna on the show.
Yep, next Wednesday. And it's going to be pretty terrific. She's got some wonderful stories. And again, I want people to listen in, because when you do, you're going to want to come hear her on Saturday. She is truly, truly that good. I'm very excited about it. And then we, So What's Your Story and the Houston Storyteller Guild, are co-sponsoring her in this concert on Saturday. She's coming in just for this community. And you know, you don't want to miss her. But then again, why would you want to miss any show any week, right?
That's right, Doc. Well, while we're talking about our show, let's talk about what's also happening with the Houston Storytellers Guild and next week's show, which you just reiterated. But I just wanted to say it again because I wanted to have the last say so. So tune in next week. Now for some updates for Houston's other amazing storytelling community, The Moth, Tatiana.
Thanks, Nicole. So The Moth holds Story Slams at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of each month. Next Tuesday, on November 14th, the theme is Control. You'll hear stories about anything from control freaks to...
Nicole, do you have a story for that, Control? Do you have one? Maybe a dozen or so? Okay, I'm sorry. I just had to get that in.
Oh, boy.
You'll
hear stories about anything from control freaks to control towers, stories about lives being out of control, and maybe even a story about control top pantyhose. It's all about holding it together. And speaking of the Moth, last Friday they had their annual huge event, the Grand Slam, and a big shout out to our own co-hosts, Greg and Hank.
Yes, I was there, and they both told riveting stories. I love their stories. I didn't always agree with the judges' scores, but that's for another time. But the theme was Out on a Limb. Greg told a story about reaching out to the governor of Texas when he was only, I think, about 14 years old. Hank told an Out on the Limb story, scary, funny story about the time he negotiated the release of five hostages from a man who was armed and dangerous. That was a riveting story as well. Lots of guests from our show were there telling stories. Kent Keith, Chris Gorman, Harwood Taylor. Harwood told a story about being literally out on a limb. Back as a teenager, he had a landscaping business, and he got in over his head, no pun intended, trying to trim a really huge tree. One of the most memorable moments for me was when Dusty Rhodes, the Moth's host, told the audience about us. So what's your story? And we got a huge ovation. There were probably 1,000 to 1,200 people there. So that was kind of cool. Thank you, Dusty. That was very nice to hear. Nicole and Teddy, I think that reflects the good work you are doing to develop our social media presence and to broaden our audience. And speaking of our social media presence... Ted?
Well, that's us. We're So What Your Story. So What's Your Story? Sorry about that. You can catch us on 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. You don't even need a radio to listen to us, though. You can stream us live from kpft.org and our Facebook page. And if you go to our Facebook page, please make sure to give us some feedback. We always value that so much. You can leave us some suggestions or just tell us what you think. Make sure you like us and share us with your friends. And if you need more, you can always check out our Instagram and Twitter.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Lots of great storytelling activities all over Houston and right here as well. Tonight's guest teller is Diane McGehee. She's a lawyer. She's a minister. And as you've heard, she's a great storyteller. Diane, we talked about doing some stories on the theme of regret. And
yes.
Then to try to end on a positive
note. Yes.
Also redemption.
Yes.
So I imagine that's a topic that lawyers and preachers think about a lot.
All the time.
As human beings. We
make mistakes. We do things we regret. Sometimes we do them intentionally and sometimes just unconsciously. And then we need to be forgiven and we need to forgive others when they do it as well so that we can reclaim our identity as people of integrity.
And so that we're not defined by our mistakes,
that's right, yeah.
Well, you and I were talking about an unfortunate, regrettable event that happened at an Astros baseball game.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could kind of tell us that story and how that reminded you of another story and how you sort of put those two stories together.
Okay, I'd be glad to. So I'm a big Astros fan. I love baseball. I'm the mother of four boys. They love baseball. My husband loves baseball. And so I got to be at all of the home playoff games with the Yankees. And then I got to be at the World Series, the first World Series home game on Friday night, October 27th. And it was just the electricity in the crowd and the excitement and just cheering on these young men. You know, I look at these baseball players and they're young enough to be my children, you know, and so you just want the best for them. And so when Yuli Gurriel hit his home run, I mean, the stands were just on fire. People were cheering and it was so exciting to watch him run the bases. And then for return to the dugout. And then for the rest of the game, it was just electric. Up, you know, all the ups and downs and then finally winning it. And it wasn't until we got home, because where we were sitting, we could see the whole field, but we couldn't see into the dugout. And so it wasn't until we got home that we heard the conversation about Gurriel entering the dugout, sitting down and making the gesture and the statements that he did. And it just broke my heart. And I knew that the minute he realized what he had done, that he regretted it and wished he could take it back. And you watched him throughout the rest of the series try to recover from that, try to make it right with the Dodgers pitcher. And we just do that. And of course, everybody was angry with him, and he needs to be held accountable. Whenever any of us do things like that, we need to be held accountable so that we restore integrity and we make relationships right. But I also thought about all the times that we do the same kind of things. And sometimes it helps us to remember the humanity of the offender, if we can remember our own humanity and the brokenness that we experience as human beings in times when we judge and do things like that. And actually, it reminded me of a story that still haunts me. 50 years, it's been more than 50 years ago, and I was in the first grade, and I didn't know what I was doing, but I do now, and it just breaks my heart. So I lived in South Georgia in a little town called Milledgeville, and I had the most amazing first grade teacher, Miss Irwin. She was a fairly poor school district, and we didn't have money for buses for field trips or any of the, you know, fancy field trips, but she created these amazing field trips. And she lived out on a little farm outside of town, and she would take us out at night to see the stars away from the town lights, and we would study the stars and, you know, astronomy. And or she'd take us out in the day out in the woods and find a meadow and have us all sit really still and get really quiet and then watch the meadow come to life with the butterflies and the bees and the flies, and then occasionally an animal, a skunk or a deer or something, would appear on the edge. And it was just magical. And so we loved her field trips. And one of the things we loved about the field trips is, because there were no buses, the parents had to volunteer to drive. And so it was a big day when your parent volunteered to drive, because then you got to pick who rode in your car. And so I remember the day that my mother was able to take off of work, and she brought our old station wagon, which meant it was her and me, and then I got to pick five friends. So we're all standing up in the front of the room, all those whose parents are there with cars, and we start picking. And of course, I picked my best friend, and then I picked my other friends, and I picked four of the five. And most of the kids have been picked. There's a few left, and it's my turn to pick the last person to ride my car. And Carolyn started jumping up and down, waving her hands, and, Diane, please pick me. Please let me ride in your car. I want to ride with you. Let me ride in your car. And Carolyn was not popular. Carolyn came to school. I can still see her. Came to school every day in the same just threadbare cotton dress. It was plaid. It had patches on it. She was really thin. You almost felt like she would break if you touched her. Her hair was rarely combed and, you know, kind of ratted. And her skin had that almost paper-thin quality. You felt like you could see through it. And she smelled. I mean, it was just awful. You didn't want to sit near her. It just smelled awful. It was almost nauseating at times. And I looked at Carolyn and I said, Carolyn, no, you can't ride with us. We don't have room. You're going to have to ride with somebody else. And the minute I said that, I saw the tears well in her eyes and her lip begin to quiver. And my mother, God bless her soul, probably saved my soul from the hell I should have been sent to for what I just did. Because she, in the way that only a mother can do, without saying a word, shot me a look that said, you are in so much trouble. Don't you say another word, and you're going to do exactly what I tell you to do. And she said that with her eyes. She didn't say a word with her lips. And I knew exactly what she was telling me. And then she turned to Carolyn. She wrapped her arms around her, and she pulled her face in front of her and looked her in the eyes and said, Carolyn, of course you can ride with us. We'd love to have you. Diane miscounted. She was mistaken. You cannot, not only can you ride with us, but you can sit right next to Diane. And she came over and she put Carolyn's hand in mine, and Carolyn's face just lit up. And that moment still haunts me. I know I was a kid. I know I didn't really understand what was going on in Carolyn's life and why she, you know, had the heartache and the difficulties she had, but that I would treat her that way just breaks my heart. And it's just, if I could find her today and say, Carolyn, please forgive me, I would do it in a minute.
How the initial regret was kind of an externalized regret that your mother created for you.
I was in trouble, big trouble.
And at some point in your life, though, that became an internal regret. Could you talk about that?
Sure. So there was a point at which I ended up on the streets myself. I knew what it was like not to have even a place to shower. Although I found one eventually. I enrolled in school and figured out how I could sleep in the student center and take showers in the gym. But I began to experience that myself, and I began to work with people who were doing the best they can, were living in poverty, and you know, being clean and having extra clothes and just wasn't something that was available. And to be judged by that, to be excluded because of what you didn't have and not for who you were, just broke my heart. And it has been what my life has been about, to try to address that, to try to help people at the margins find their place, find their dignity, be given the resources so that they can thrive for the people that they are.
So you literally had a time in your life when you...
Yeah, I was homeless. I went through a divorce in a religious community that didn't accept that, and I had been sexually assaulted within that religious community, and when I named it, I was no longer welcomed there, and I found myself on the streets. But God has redeemed that for me, and I know who I am. And because of what God has done in my life, I want to offer that space to other people.
Wow. That story has a lot of motifs that help it to be, that make it so real. You talked about, you described Carolyn.
I can still see her.
In detail.
I mean,
what you saw, what you smelled.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's 50 years ago?
That's 50 years ago, yeah. I don't want any child to ever feel what I know she felt in that moment.
Right. And then your mom, you didn't say a lot about her, but just the way she shot her eyes at you, I think every person knows exactly what you're talking about there.
Yeah, moms know how to give that look. My children know it when I give it to them.
And I was prepared for the discipline part of it. But I wasn't prepared for her to wrap her arms around Carolyn as sweetly as she did, in such so instinctively and quickly.
Yeah.
And that was a surprise, a pleasant surprise as a listener to that story. And then you followed up by saying you experienced some of the same marginalization that Carolyn had experienced.
Yes, yeah. And so that's part of it. We don't have to actually experience that, but empathy is about being able to enter into somebody else's reality and have some sense of the impact of that on them and what their life is like, so that then we can enter into a relationship that actually gives dignity, that honors who they are and what they have to offer, even in their circumstances, and that lifts us all up.
One of the things I like about the way you connect now, really three different stories, and going back to the baseball story, which is where we started. I mean, baseball seems like such a mundane, just a fun recreation thing, but, you know, some very important, meaningful events are taking place that go beyond just a game.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and they're people that children look up to and that actually can make huge contributions because of their power and their status, and most of them use that very well.
Yeah. And I remember when Guriel tipped his hat to
yes.
you, Darvish.
And I thought that was a powerful moment and a very dignified thing to do, and my hat went off to him for it.
Mine too. We replayed that over and over on our television.
And I just know his heart was just eating at that. He wished he could go back.
And Darvish handled it all with such sportsmanship
as well. Oh, with incredible dignity and with forgiveness.
Yeah, exactly. So even as regrettable as that was, a lot of good has come out of it, I think.
And so there's a teaching moment in it as we watch people respond to mistakes and restore people and restore one another.
Well, we talked about ending on a redemption story. I feel like we've already been there, but how about one from the Bible?
Okay. So actually, this is one of my favorites. Peter was a disciple of Jesus. He was a fisherman. He left everything to follow Jesus. He loved Jesus dearly. And he bragged about the fact that he would never forsake Jesus, would always be there for him. And I believe he meant that with his heart. But when Jesus was arrested and taken before Pilate and the Sanhedrin to be tried, he followed along the shadows. He was terrified of what was happening. And in the moment of the trial, as Jesus is being questioned, it's in an open area, and Peter's kind of off to the side by a fire in the shadows. He's questioned by three different people. You're a Galilean. You're one of his followers. You know him, don't you? And he adamantly refuses to admit that. As a matter of fact, he denies it. I don't know him. I never knew him. I'm not one of his followers. And three times he does that. And on the third time he looks up and he sees Jesus looking at him, and he knows that Jesus knows, and his heart is shattered and he flees. And of course, Jesus then is taken and crucified, and Peter is devastated. He failed in the moment that most mattered to him. And so, of course, Christians affirm that Jesus was raised from the dead, and he appeared to his disciples. And in one of those appearances, Peter has gone back to fishing. He kind of feels like he's totally failed at what mattered most. This shame is just heavy on him. And he's out fishing with some of the other disciples overnight. They don't catch anything. They're coming in. They're tired. They're exhausted. They're discouraged. And they see a figure on the shoreline. And as they get closer, it's a man. And he calls out to them, "Have you caught anything?" And they're like, "No, we tried all night, you know." And he goes, "Well, just throw your net on the other side of the boat." And you can imagine them thinking, "Oh, really? Come on. I mean, we're fishermen. And we know what we've done. We've tried this." But they go ahead and they do it anyway. And when they do, the net fills with fish, so much so that they can't drag it in. And in that moment, Peter recognizes the man on the shore as Jesus. And he leaps from the boat. He's up to his neck in water, and he makes his way through. He wades through all that water to the shoreline. And Jesus has set a fire, has cooked fish for breakfast, and has him sit down, and he feeds him breakfast, and the other disciples gather, and they eat together. And that's when the healing begins. But Peter still is in this conflicted state because he's so glad to see Jesus. He's so glad that he's alive. He's having breakfast with him, and yet he's carrying this incredible shame that's just weighing him. He wants to flee. And Jesus takes him aside, looks him in the eye, and asks him three times, "Peter, do you love me?" And Peter responds, "Lord, you know that I do." And Jesus says, "Feed my lambs." And then he asks him again, "Peter," he looks him in the eyes, "do you love me?" And Peter says, "Lord, you know that I do." And Jesus says, "Feed my sheep." And one more time, for the three times that Peter had denied him, Jesus is restoring him. Mm-hmm. He says, "Peter, do you love me?" And Peter says, "Lord, you know that I do." And Jesus says, "Feed my sheep." And what Jesus does in that moment is he affirms Peter's love for himself, for Jesus. And in that affirmation extends his forgiveness and restores him, because he sends him out then to lead the witness of the gospel and the resurrection of Christ. But in asking him, "Do you love me?" he helps Peter forgive himself, because Peter is able to affirm what he knows is true about himself and claim that identity, not the identity of his shame and his mistake, so that he's no longer defined by that. He's defined now, forgiven not only by Jesus, but able to forgive himself as the one who does love him. That's his identity. And in fact, he goes on and gives his life in service to the world, and eventually gives his life because of his witness to Christ. And it's an incredible story of how we can redeem broken moments by extending forgiveness, but also allowing the person we're forgiving to forgive themselves and reclaim their identity as who they truly are.
What would you like our listeners to take from that story?
We all make mistakes. We're broken. We're broken in our humanness. We judge people. We do things, sometimes horrible things, but none of us are beyond forgiveness. And we need to learn to forgive ourselves. We need to accept the forgiveness extended to us when it is. We need to extend forgiveness to others because we're all made in the image of God. We all have this incredible dignity and worth. And we all act out of a brokenness that is not who we really are. And so when we allow ourselves to be forgiven, when we forgive ourselves, we allow ourselves and others to claim who we really are and then live out of that space rather than out of the mistakes that we've made.
You said that I had never noticed this before. That's a familiar story, but that there were three denials.
Yes.
And so the shame sort of piles a little higher each time.
It does.
He digs himself into a deeper hole. And I never noticed, but Jesus digs him out.
He peels off it layer by layer. Yeah. He gives him a chance to redeem each one of those denials and to reclaim who he really is, which is a man who deeply loves Jesus.
And I know you have a theological and a humanitarian reason for telling that story, but just purely from a storytelling technique kind of point of view, those three, the three and the three in parallel, is just amazing to me.
It is. I mean, so the gospel writers were master storytellers. The, you know, we read, especially as preachers, we're taught to dissect this text and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But the gospels, and actually most of the New Testament, Old Testament, were orally told. Mm-hmm. It's an oral tradition, and we've lost so much of that because we read it oftentimes and it's flat as a text. But when you tell it, when you enter the story and let it come alive as you tell it orally, there are things like that that just surface that, wow. And so these stories are very carefully crafted as part of an oral tradition like that layering. And it's mm-hmm. really fun to go in and discover what's there when you begin to tell the story from different character viewpoints, as we said earlier, because each person in the story plays a role and the story impacts them differently and they impact the story differently.
We like to think that in the 21st century, you know, things get better with each generation, and scientifically and technologically, certainly they do. But it may be that storytelling is a skill that we're not as good at as our ancestors.
We could learn a lot. And actually, it's really interesting because, you know, my children's generation and some that are younger really are not as textually literate or focused as I was. And they're much more in tune with the storytelling, with images, with words and how they create this space and this creative, imaginative ability to think about the world differently. And so I think reclaiming storytelling is a way of entering, a way of touching this generation in a way that perhaps mine just wasn't even open to.
I'm going to bring Hank back in now. He's our storytelling expert. Hank, your thoughts about our conversation and about Diane's story?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I tout myself as a storytelling expert, but, you know, I obviously have looked into it for a while. But, you know, I can tell you with great confidence and even more conviction that this generation doesn't appreciate the idea of stories as much as previous generations. And in many ways, that's what makes it so fun to teach it to them, because it's new, it's fresh. It's a world where, you know, the stories that you're telling, for example, Diane, are not based on special effects. They're not based on, you know, external stimuli that somehow is created for us. You are the one who has to bring this alive. And to do that, you have to have a good sense of meaning of words. You've got to read a lot of books. You really have to understand the beauty of words and images. And that, I think that's what you do so well. You know, you enter a story in a way that is unsuspecting to listeners. We realize that you're in a story when you're about one third of the way through it because you own it so beautifully. For example, earlier Warren was talking about a story that might have been told a million times, but you know, Diane, you have an ability to tell a story so that it is incredibly fresh, as if we've heard it for the first time. You and Rabbi Karf, Sam Karf, you probably know.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And Seymour Rozelle, both of whom I'm so proud to call friends, have been on the show. And the three of you have this one thing in common. You have what's called a sense of communication. You have an ability to talk to people rather than at them. You have an ability to share information rather than give it. And ultimately, you get people involved in a message. And you do it with such a poignant and profound point of view. I'm so happy that you were Warren's guest tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I love telling stories. And I love the way that stories do create a space for people to enter and connect with their own story. And actually, when people are able to connect their story to another story, it creates this space where they can actually craft a whole new story by combining them in some way. And so, it's a very creative, imaginative space that actually has the ability to help us transform the way we see ourselves, the way we see the world, the way we see each other.
Right. Very transformative. Just a beautiful job. Love the way you told these stories tonight.
Thank you.
You also have a way of separating religion from spirituality in my own mind, which is a difficult thing to do.
I think probably because in my own experience, religion can be hurtful. But if you can think about it as we're all spiritual beings, there's a connection point for all of us.
Well, can you believe it? Our time is almost up. I wish we could go on. Diane, you shared traditional and religious stories and stories right out of the newspaper and Minute Maid Park. Stories from your own life as well. You took us on journeys and you brought us home safe and sound. And we had a lot of fun.
We did.
And I just think it's so nice when we come from different backgrounds and we hear these stories and we all connect with them in different ways. So thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really had a good time.
It was our delight. And we hope you'll come back.
I'd love to. Thank you.
Well, don't you dare move, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are waiting in the wings to share their cool classics with you. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story. And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Warren Holloman, along with Diane McGehee, and the entire So What's Your Story team. And we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.